Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Every week, I read from Entertainment Weekly, and their website is EW.com. This week, I've got a lot of television, so let's start with some movies first. Challengers serves up a grand slam of psychosexual passion and tension. It's game, set, match for the must-see movie of the spring. This is by Maureen Lee Lenker. Sure, sex is great, but have you ever seen a really good game of tennis? That is, ostensibly, at least in a tongue-in-cheek way, the question at the heart of Challengers, the riveting new drama from Luca Guadagnino, who we know from Call Me By Your Name. Built around a Challengers tournament match between former friends turned rivals, Art Donaldson, played by Mike Feist, and Patrick Swayze, played by Josh O'Connor, the film volleys between timelines as swiftly as a tennis ball, shading the contours of the duo's past. The linchpin between them is Tashi Donaldson, played by Zendaya, a promising young tennis star they both lust after. Tashi really only cares about one thing, though, tennis, and she pits the boys against each other with the aim of amping up their game. After an initial dalliance with Patrick and a career-ending injury, Tashi comes to coach and eventually marries Art. She registers Art in a Challengers tournament, seemingly with the aim of boosting his confidence before he makes one last run at winning the U.S. Open, and their regrets and recriminations come to a head when he must face off against Patrick in the finals. Justin Kuritsky's twisty script leaves us guessing as the trio's mind games wreak havoc on each other and the audience all at once. Zendaya has called the project Codependency, the movie, and it is a deliciously audacious tale of three damaged people who cannot live without each other. There is lust and loathing in equal measure, but the primary truism is that they are hopelessly entangled with each other, for better or worse. Tashi's kink is tennis. Not mediocre or even good tennis, but fantastic, highlight reel, once-in-a-generation tennis. From the moment she shows up to the boys' hotel room late one night, initiates a three-way makeout session, and then promises to give her number to whichever one of them wins their match the next day, she appoints herself puppet master of their lives to push them into playing that elusive, perfect game. Zendaya is the film's murky center, a woman whose desires and goals are, at times, a mystery even to herself. As the teenage Tashi, a 19-year-old star who chooses Stanford University over the professional circuit, she expertly toes the line between adolescent angst and cool detachment. Even she seems uncertain whether she's playing Art and Patrick against each other or accidentally playing herself. With her Disney Channel roots, Zendaya brings a complicated blend of earnest youthfulness and enigmatic candor to the role. Her performance falters slightly as the older Tashi, wife to Art and mother of their child. She's meant to be cold and calculating, but Zendaya has an inherent warmth that sometimes undercuts the chilly, pathological obsession with winning that defines Tashi's raison d'etre. There's no question she possesses the radiant confidence of an adult woman, but there's still something girlish there. At times, it's effective, making us question whether she's the manipulator or the manipulated. But a deeper maturity, necessary to make the performance a true grand slam, is lacking. Luckily, that gravitas comes via her two co-stars, Josh O'Connor, who we know from The Crown, and Mike Feist, who we know from West Side Story. O'Connor's Patrick is all empty swagger, a smirking husk of a man with a gaping, ugly maw of want at his center. In contrast, Feist's Art is the ultimate beta male, a guy who gets the girl through patient ingratiation rather than grandstanding, in contrast to Patrick's literal dick-swinging. Both actors have quickly become two of the most interesting young male stars working today, after breaking out in a Tony-nominated role in Dear Evan Hansen on Broadway. Feist brought feral desperation to Riff, dancing away with Steven Spielberg's West Side Story. O'Connor won an Emmy for his portrayal of the bitterly overlooked young Prince Charles on The Crown. Here, they complicate their types, delivering two elegant backhanded serves of a performance. Feist channels his raw, wounded energy into Art's petty pretty boy charm, while the shrewd competitor remains visible in his keenly emotive eyes. O'Connor has found success playing hapless, unloved men, but here, his gift for inhabiting entitled figures lends him bravado and striking sex appeal. The trio of actors all share a crackling chemistry, but the electricity between O'Connor and Feist is the strongest. Both men engage in passionate scenes with Zendaya, making out in intense close-ups and tearing clothes off with palpable want. But none of those more physical scenes sear with the level of heat that O'Connor and Feist create with a mere shared glance. Guadagnino laces the proceedings with potent homoeroticism, suggesting that Tashi is merely the conduit for the men's lust and need for each other. It's a psychosexual masterclass, their barely tamped-down desire colliding and exploding everywhere from the tennis court to a steamy sauna. The entire film can be encapsulated in that pivotal sauna scene where they circle each other like jungle cats. Art tries to conceal his longing with a false confidence while Patrick revels in his ability to unsettle his former friend. There's nothing particularly subtle about their repressed desire, from the literality of a steam-filled room to the amount of phallic foods they swallow down, bananas, churros, hot dogs. But it's so deliciously fun that it doesn't matter. This almost campy emphasis on sexual power dynamics is enhanced by Guadagnino's shooting style. The director positions his camera in unexpected places, shooting a sloppy, tongue-filled kiss from a low-angle close-up, turning the audience into the tennis ball zooming back and forth, and even showing us the match from beneath the men's shoes. We can viscerally feel the physical strain of the sport through these choices. The way the lift of a shirt's hem or the spring of a graceful serve is as carnal as sex for these three people. In Guadagnino's hands, sex is a tennis match. Not to be overlooked is Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross's spectacular score. Since 2010's The Social Network, the duo has been expanding the possibilities of film's aural landscape. Here, they craft a pulsating, synth-filled composition that ratchets up the tension until it's taut as the strings of a racket. It's as if the U.S. Open decided to use sonic riffs from Miami Vice as a theme song. The electronic staccato rhythm mimics the rapid back and forth of tennis, while also catapulting us into a sound that is inherently sexy in the ways it evokes the hypnotic trance of a dance club. Anchored by three arresting performances and playful experimental direction, Challengers is fresh, exhilarating, and energetic. It pushes the boundaries of its devilishly fun packaging, exploring the power dynamics of sex, desire, and competition with a winking reminder that sometimes love is a zero-sum game. That was Challengers serves up a grand slam of psychosexual passion and tension. It was by Maureen Lee Lanker, and she's giving the movie Challengers a grade of A-. Next, we have Alex Garland's Civil War. It's a political thriller that's light on politics. Kirsten Dunst stars as an unflinching photojournalist documenting war-torn America in a movie that never quite earns its provocative premise. This is by Devin Coggan. Civil War, Alex Garland's ambitious new thriller, hinges on an irresistible premise. What if the United States really did devolve into a second civil war? It's an intriguing narrative idea, made all the more effective by the current polarized state of American democracy. When it feels like every news broadcast is filled with imagery of protests and insurrections, there's something resonant and devastatingly timely about Garland's vision of an American conflict. The result is a brutal piece of speculative fiction that highlights the ugliness of war, even if it never quite lives up to its provocative premise. Set in a not-too-far future, civil war finds the country already embroiled in battle. An unnamed president, played by Nick Offerman, is holed up in the White House, facing secessionist troops referred to as the Western Forces, an unexpected alliance between Texas and California. Florida has also seceded, and in typical Florida fashion, they're doing sort of their own thing. Chronicling the carnage is celebrated war photographer Lee, played by Kirsten Dunst, who built her career snapping photos of the war front overseas. Her name, of course, is a nod to legendary war photographer Lee Miller, who covered World War II for Vogue. Now she's come home, using her camera to capture apocalyptic images of American-on-American violence. After reporting on protests in a ravaged New York City, she and her colleague Joel, played by Wagner Moura, make plans to head south, journeying to the quote-unquote front lines in Charlottesville, Virginia, before trekking to D.C. to try to score an interview with the president. It's a dangerous mission, especially when the current administration has a history of executing journalists on the South Lawn. They're joined by aging old-timer Sammy, played by Stephen McKinley Henderson, perfect, as always, who works for what's left of the New York Times, and aspiring 23-year-old photojournalist Jesse, played by Kaylee Spaney, who hopes to follow in Lee's footsteps. Together, this odd quartet sets out on an uncomfortable road trip, dodging bullets and weaving through backroads as they document a burning America. As a Civil War movie, Civil War is well made, dropping audiences into the shock and terror of American slaughter. Garland sprinkles every battlefield with jarring touches, whether it's a crashed helicopter in a JCPenney parking lot or a refugee camp set in a high school football stadium. Lit by rockets' red glare, the battle scenes are unsettling, violent, and loud, punctuated by brief moments of silence as we hear the click of Lee and Jesse's cameras. It's also an effective journalism movie, exploring what exactly drives these writers and photographers to risk life and limb. At first, Jesse is horrified by the violence she witnesses, and early on, when she encounters a man brutalizing two captives at a rural gas station, she freezes. But as the journey continues, she's slowly desensitized to the trauma, chasing every new skirmish like a combat adrenaline junkie. But as a political movie, Civil War is less effective. Garland is careful never to explain why the war has broken out, but instead is more interested in capturing the anarchy. We learn that Lee made her name covering something called the Antifa Massacre, but the film never confirms who was massacred or who did the massacring. Similarly, little is known about Offerman's POTUS and his potential political leanings, only that he's now in his third term and has already disbanded the FBI. All that political ambiguity is an intentional choice, but it feels like a cheap one. Civil War feels kind of like a political pundit who likes to just ask questions, but never actually engage with them on a deeper level. Even as Garland's vision remains frustratingly opaque, it's elevated by some stellar performances. Dunst is unsurprisingly excellent as Lee, who chronicles the carnage with the world-weary resolve of someone who's seen 1,000 firefights and 1,000 bloodstains. Still, Dunst finds flickers of kindness and humanity under Lee's battle-hardened exterior, especially when interacting with her fellow Sofia Coppola muse Spaney. The 25-year-old Priscilla actress perfectly balances Jesse's wide-eyed naivety and tenaciousness as the young journalist is horrified by the violence but unable to look away. Together, they make an unlikely mentor-mentee relationship. Lee can't help but resentfully pass on her knowledge, even as she's internally begging Jesse to run to safety. Plus, the eternally underrated Henderson shines as Sammy, bringing a warmth and veteran stability to the trip. But above all, Civil War is here for the carnage, and Garland captures the chaos with an unflinching eye, just as his journalistic protagonists do. The violence is brutal, whether that's a tense sniper battle on a country backroad or an explosive final assault on the streets of D.C. War is hell, the film reminds us over and over again. But what happens when hell comes home? That was Alex Garland's Civil War is a political thriller that's light on politics. It was by Devin Coggan, and she's giving the movie a rating of C+. We also had a Curb Your Enthusiasm series finale recently, and this is the review of it. Larry gets his Seinfeld do-over. Larry David, the king of grievance, hangs up his crown with no lessons learned. This is by Kristen Baldwin. And there's a warning. This article contains spoilers about Curb Your Enthusiasm's season finale, No Lessons Learned. I'm 76 years old, and I have never learned a lesson in my entire life. So boasted Larry David, Seinfeld co-creator and celebrity curmudgeon in the series finale of Curb Your Enthusiasm. But that was TV Larry talking, the real Larry David, who played a heightened version of himself on Curb, turned No Lessons Learned into a mea culpa for the looming series finale sin of his past. Rather than serving viewers a steaming cup of spite, David and showrunner Jeff Schaefer wrapped up Curb's quarter-century run with a cocktail of nostalgic callbacks, celebrity cameos, petty grievances, and a characteristically cynical attempt at redemption. Before he turned griping about minutiae, the stop and chat, save the dates, and so much more into an art form on Curb Your Enthusiasm, David helped create television's first ever sitcom antiheroes with Seinfeld. But at their worst, Jerry, Elaine, George, and Kramer never reached the antisocial heights, depths, of their miserable maker. In Larry David, Curb Your Enthusiasm, the 1999 HBO special that served as a pilot for Curb, Jason Alexander recalls his confusion over George's behavior in an early Seinfeld episode. This would never happen in real life, but certainly if it did happen in real life, no one would react like this, he told the writers. And Larry came up and he said, "This happened to me, and this is exactly what I did." It made sense that George Costanza, a frequently unemployed, romantically challenged schmuck, would live his life in a state of permanent umbrage. And it's completely absurd that Curb Your Enthusiasm's Larry David, a millionaire with a beautiful wife, played by Cheryl Hines, and no legitimate responsibilities, somehow found even more to complain about. Everything in his environment and his context of his life has been changed, noted Jerry Seinfeld in the special. Everything. And he is exactly the same. That disconnect served as the foundation of Larry's farcical Curb follies over the next 24 years. The affronts took many forms: a bathroom door with no lock, cold coffee, faulty weather forecasts. And the payoff for his pettiness was often humiliation, condemnation, or reluctant remuneration. Though his character endured endless and often earned abuse, for the real Larry David, TV Larry David was an outlet for his id. On the show, I can say things I think about which I can't say in life, he told Entertainment Weekly in 2002. I can get into arguments that I wouldn't get into. For viewers, it was intoxicating to watch. What must it be like having the privilege to be such an a-hole? And for many celebrity guest stars, Curb offered them a chance to indulge the worst versions of themselves. Was there anything as sublimely sinister as Michael J. Fox, universally beloved actor and philanthropist, trolling downstairs neighbor Larry and blaming it all on his Parkinson's? Seinfeld spawned countless imitators, but Curb Your Enthusiasm is now its own genre, the Kleenex of celebrity mockumentaries. Pete Davidson to play himself in Curb Your Enthusiasm-like comedy. David's creative process: he wrote detailed outlines for each episode but let the actors improvise their way from point A to point B, only served to enhance the veracity of what we saw on screen. Characters on Curb interrupt and talk over each other, sputter out incomplete sentences, and react like people do in real conversation. Because that's what they were. Almost. Whether an episode was great or just okay, it was always a joy to see one of Curb's ad-lib all-stars, usually J.B. Smoove or the late Richard Lewis, elicit a genuine laugh from Larry. In our rational minds, we knew it wasn't real. Still, when a newly divorced Ted Danson, a recurring player throughout the series' run, started dating Larry's ex-wife in season 10, Danson had to assure worried fans that he and Mary Steenburgen were, in fact, still married in real life. 11 seasons, 120 episodes, so many of which are now considered classics in the annals of cringe comedy. Personal preferences may vary. Nothing Larry said will ever be funnier to me than, "Let me tell you something. I do hate myself, but it has nothing to do with being Jewish, okay?" But most of us can agree on the all-time greats: Palestinian Chicken, Trick or Treat, Seinfeld, The Doll, Crazy Eyes Killa, Lewis Needs a Kidney. Curb took a 6-year break after season 8 and another 3-year break after season 9. Each time, no one, not even the suits at HBO, knew if Larry would be back. Still, back he came for 3 more seasons, and each one delivered diminishing comedic returns. The weekly peccadilloes Larry faced felt increasingly forced, and his screwball strategies to escape social obligations were less and less grounded in reality. The season's 7th episode, The Dream Scheme, might be the series' nadir. Despite the lack of laughs, at least season 12 had a clear purpose: redemption. He's not at peace with himself after he bombs, until he goes up on stage again and does well, explained Larry's manager Jeff Green, played by Jeff Garlin, in the original Curb special. And the Seinfeld finale, which Larry David returned to write after leaving the series in season 7, is preserved in pop culture amber as a certified bomb. So just as Seinfeld's final episode found the core for standing trial for violating a Good Samaritan law, Curb's final season saw Larry being arrested and tried for being a Good Samaritan. Technically, he violated Georgia's Election Integrity Act, which prohibits handing out water or food to people waiting in line to vote. The 56-minute No Lessons Learned follows Larry and his posse of supporters: Jeff, Susie, played by Susie Essman, Leon, played by Smoove, Richard, Cheryl, and Danson, down to Atlanta for the trial. No matter how many times his lawyer, Sibby Sanders, played by Sana Lathan, tries to impress upon him how grave his situation is, if you get convicted, you'll be a felon. Larry is pathologically incapable of taking the proceeding seriously. He remains myopically focused on minor things, proving that Lewis's girlfriend, Cynthia, played by guest star Allison Janney, is lying about her suicide attempt, helping Jeff trick Aunt Ray, played by Ella English, into giving him her salad dressing recipe, scolding Danson for trying to steal his limelight by protesting the election integrity law outside the courthouse. And as Larry confesses to Jerry Seinfeld, who also comes to Atlanta in a show of support, he's not even thinking about the trial during the trial. Their subsequent exchange about a hypothetical romance with a beautiful bearded lady was the finale's best moment, a pure and potent hit of the duo's singular dynamic. Much of the episode played out as a deliberate remake of Seinfeld's The Finale with people from Larry's past. Mocha Joe, played by Severino Guerra, Rachel Hyneman, played by Iris Barr, and even little Tara Mickelson, played by Bailey Thompson, now all grown up and still traumatized by that hug so many years ago, taking the stand to testify about their David-induced injuries. Larry David doesn't respect the law, prosecutor Earl Mack, played by guest star Greg Kinnear, warns the jury. He lives outside, unrestrained by the guardrails of human decency. And like Jerry, Elaine, George, and Kramer, Larry David is convicted and sentenced by the judge, played by guest star Dean Norris, to a year in prison. Just when it seems that Curb is going to end as it began, with Larry fretting about his pants tent, along came that twist, a slender, seemingly irrelevant string of connective plot tissue that loops back to save the day. Jerry himself delivers the news. Mistrial declared, charges thrown out. And as he and Larry stroll out of the jail, Larry has a revelation. Oh my God, this is how we should have ended the finale. Does actual Larry David believe that, or is he just giving fans what he thinks they want so they'll get off his back already? My sense is the latter, but I'm not sure it really matters. What's most important is that Larry David, comedy's most indefatigable anti-hero, is free to live unhappily ever after, learning nothing along the way. That was Curb Your Enthusiasm series finale review, Larry Gets His Seinfeld Do-Over. It was by Kristen Baldwin, and she's giving two grades, the series finale grade a B, and the overall series grade an A-. Here's my midpoint where I'll mention that you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly, and I'm reading from their website, EW.com. Next, I have a big article. It's the 20 best cooking shows on Netflix. The Big Red Streamer offers a vast menu of delicious fare. This is by Debbie Wolfenson. The way to a person's heart is through their stomach, and you will fall in love with these food-focused series. From travelogues to practical cooking tips to culinary explorations of history and geography, Netflix has proven itself a patron of the broadcast gastronomical arts, offering both ebullient entertainment, we'll see, is it cake, as well as educated edible analysis, we'll see The Great British Baking Show and Somebody Feed Phil. Netflix holds a special place in the hearts of home cooks and food enthusiasts alike. So grab a plate and take a seat. It's time to chow down on Entertainment Weekly's list of the 20 best cooking shows on Netflix. The first one is Bake Squad, from 2021 to present. Bake Squad puts the spotlight on talent, and while there is an element of competition, the client has to choose one of the creations, it's all very good-natured. Led by a respected figure in the cooking world, that's author, baker, and Milk Bar founder Christina Tosi, the squad is made up of four amazingly artistic, wholly unique bakers creating some awesome feats of flour, butter, and sugar. An exploding cake? Yes! A floating cake? Why not? How about a life-size chocolate piano, or a giant chocolate dragon egg, or a super-sized smash cake? Let's do this! Watching this show feels like hanging out in the kitchen at a really cool bakery, spying on all of the mind-blowingly elaborate techniques. Truly, no idea is too crazy for Bake Squad, and we love them for it. Next, it's Best Leftovers Ever. That started in 2020, or it's from 2020. A makeover show for leftovers? We can get behind that. Now, a show all about those bits and bobs left in your fridge from last night might not seem like the most highbrow offering on the Netflix cooking show menu, but it just might be the most important. Why? Well, as you probably know, billions of pounds of food is wasted every year in the United States alone. But not if Best Leftovers Ever can help it. Hosted by actress Jackie Tone, who we know from as Melanie Melrose Rosen of Glow, creativity rules here. Whether you're turning dinner into breakfast, kids' meals into cocktail apps, or Mexican fare into gnocchi? By amping up the flavor and presentation, the revolving cast of enthusiastic competitors, an assortment of real folks from home cooks to personal chefs battling for a $10,000 prize, really does manage to transform fridge-chilled blah to restaurant-ready yum. Breakfast, Lunch, and Dinner was from 2019. Noodles with Weird Barbie, that's Kate McKinnon, in Cambodia. Couscous with Chrissy Teigen in Marrakesh? Yes, please. This show is a slightly decadent and occasionally ridiculous pleasure, like traveling with a true friend. No stress, no drama, no worries about calorie counts, and no pressure to learn stuff. In fact, one of the first things Tegan says upon greeting host David Chang in her amazing Moroccan villa is, "I shall teach you." No, I won't. And while Chang, plus celebrity guest, plus traveling to a fabulous destination while eating tons of delicious food, might have been a clever way to get Netflix to pay for some glam R&R. Kidding? We don't mind one bit, because the result, 4 jam-packed episodes, is pure escapist fun. That was Breakfast, Lunch, and Dinner is the name of the show. The next one is The Chef Show. It's been running since 2019. We admit it, The Chef Show gives us the warm fuzzies, effortlessly transferring the 2014 movie Chef's look, feel, color palette, and heart from the big to the small screen. Producer and star Jon Favreau connects food to friendship in every frame. Reuniting with his buddy and producing partner Roy Choi, whose fusion taco truck Koji served as Chef's inspo, this series feels like a true labor of love. Choi, a creative wizard who taught Favreau how to cook like a pro for the film, bringing him up to speed on everything from knife skills to prep to finishing touches, shares the screen with the actor on all sorts of culinary adventures, from baking bread at Tartine to assembling a giant lasagna. The Chef Show is like a food series meets buddy comedy, and the result is as irresistible as their famous grilled cheese. That was The Chef Show. Next, we have Chef's Table. That ran from 2015 to 2019. An essential staple in any foodie's streaming pantry, Chef's Table is known for stunningly shot, in-depth episodes focusing on fantastic fare and the lives of the cooks who create it. Following one chef per episode, our writer called this globe-spanning series the gold standard of cooking shows, presenting gorgeous dishes and ingredients with sumptuous cinematography that makes every culinary creation look like a beautiful work of art. Chef's Table has spawned many spin-offs as well, from barbecue to French cuisine. In other words, this Netflix original series makes for perfect dinnertime viewing, whether you're eating cold pizza or a four-course meal. And one of those episodes features Chris Bianco, our own Phoenix celebrity. Number 6 is Flavorful Origins. It's been running since 2020. Remember what we said about Netflix taking a serious approach to cooking shows? Exhibit A would have to be Flavorful Origins. Spanning 40 episodes across 3 seasons, this Chinese docuseries goes deep, y'all, and you can forget about sweet and sour anything. This is a crash course in authentic Chinese cuisine, though the episode names gluten, mutton, cooked chopped entrails of sheep, tofu cake, etc. probably gave this away. The seasons are divided by region and feel like traveling across China with a knowledgeable guide. A mini cooking school via quick hit sub 15-minute episodes, this subtitled dive into the awe-inspiring varieties of the nation's food is doggedly uncommercial and a total treat. That was Flavorful Origins. Fresh Fried and Crispy was in 2021. Impressively bearded, irrepressibly charming, and absolutely willing to take giant bites of uber-crunchy food on camera, Dame Drops is the host with the most enthusiasm. This YouTuber-turned-Netflix food fanatic travels the U.S. in pursuit of the best in fried fare, sampling heart-stopping delicacies like fried mac and cheese, fried Oreos, and something called a whale burger, which we're not sure we even want to know about. Drops isn't just super funny, he's fearless, too. Watching him bravely bite into a deep-fried Rocky Mountain oyster, if you know, you know, on the Denver episode is truly squirm-inducing fun. That was Fresh, Fried, and Crispy. The Great British Baking Show has been running since 2010, and that's our number 8 entry. Despite some bumps, Mexican week, and host swaps, everyone's favorite UK import is still as soothing as a warm cuppa. The politest of all cooking competitions, this program has always been a pleasant and, yes, educational venture. Though that doesn't quite explain its longevity. Here's is a theory. In this fractured era of individualized content and heated political discourse, it's quite lovely to agree on something, even if it's just universally deriving joy from watching bakers ice tarts beneath a crispy white tent. From its origins on BBC to its first American spot, PBS, to its current home on Netflix, the show continues to highlight British culinary curiosities. Devonshire splits, Bakewell tarts, maids of honor, along with the inherent magic of turning basic ingredients into art. And things have only gotten tastier as the series continues. Because while Paul Hollywood and Prue Leith are still judges, if that ain't broke, Matt Lucas has been replaced by beloved British morning show host Alison Hammond, known for completely disarming Harrison Ford. P.S., the chemistry between Hammond and co-host Noel Fielding is like a Victoria sponge with extra cream, which is to say perfect. That was the Great British Baking Show. Number 9, Iron Chef, Quest for an Iron Legend from 2022. Who will win the Golden Knife? This Netflix reboot of the Food Network staple proves that Iron Chefs never die, they just get resurrected. Famed host, writer, nerd Alton Brown again takes the reins alongside Top Chef champ Christian Kish and actor martial artist Mark Dacascos, returning as the chairman for play-by-plays, ooing and aahing as celebrity chefs face off against regular ones. And yes, this batch of Iron Chefs is on fire. Gabriella Camara, Curtis Stone, and Dominique Crenn bring stellar credentials from around the globe, alongside legendary restaurateur, best-selling author Marcus Samuelson, and one of the OG PBS chefs, Ming Tsai. Together, they bring the noise to Kitchen Stadium once more. That was Iron Chef, The Quest for an Iron Legend. Number 10 is It Cake? Yet another successful meme-to-series transformation. See, nailed it. Is It Cake scratches our itch for fun while serving up major eye candy. Make that eye cake, which admittedly doesn't roll off the tongue as well. Edible optical illusions taken to the nth degree, this show is an invitation to marvel at an elite force of skilled bakers pulling off the impossible, disguising dessert as a roll of toilet paper? A shoe? A cash register with money sticking out of it? Yep, it's all made out of cake. This is the kind of show you have to see to believe. Again, the cash register, guys. And when you do see it, you won't be able to look away. Even if you start yelling something along the lines of, "No way!" at the screen, it's okay. We get it. With his mix of aw shucks sincerity and a slightly sinister grin, Saturday Night Live cast member Mikey Day is the ideal host for such bizarre yet tasty proceedings. A third season is now streaming. Number 11 is The K-Food Show from 2022 on. Divided into three seasons, series, with just two or three episodes in each installment, this is an incredibly mouth-watering cooking show that we have trouble watching on an empty stomach. Each season focuses on a different Korean delicacy, a nation of kimchi, a nation of banchan, a nation of broth, allocating time to fully explore each. And even though kimchi alone, with its rich history, array of techniques, and variations, is worthy of a four-hour feature film, these two sub-60-minute episodes will have to do. K-Food Show is a beautiful travelogue of a fascinating country with some seriously incredible food, and watching it is like taking a dream vacation without ever leaving home. Number 12 is Nadia's Time to Eat from 2019. cookbook author Nadia Hussain, a Great British Baking Show winner, is not just a warm, friendly, creative force in the kitchen, she's also an incredibly soothing presence for new cooks. Time to Eat is the kind of show that not only makes you think, hey, I could do that, but hey, I want to do that. Presenting a series of healthy and surprising dishes that are both mouth-watering and super cool. Peanut, chicken, tray bake, and ingenious noodles in a jar are just two examples. Hussain, unlike some TV chefs who shall not be named, never forgets that real home cooks have time-crunched lives, needing to fit meal prep somewhere between jobs, school, commutes, chores, and everything else. Parents and all busy folks around the world owe her a standing ovation. Nailed It is our next show that we just heard mentioned in the same vein with Is It Cake? That's been running since 2018. Part comedy, part baking show, and 100% unbridled silliness, Nailed It was the first show to spring from a popular Pinterest meme. In this case, home bakers posting snaps of their extremely messed up creations alongside their inspirations, summing up the ridiculousness of the entire Martha Stewart era in one neat moment. Not to get philosophical, but in these broken and crumbling creations, do we perhaps see ourselves? Setting impossibly high standards, trying our best, and failing publicly? Observing do-it-yourselfers attempt ridiculously complex challenges with lackluster results isn't just funny, it's also inspiring. We raise our flour-dusted fists in solidarity. Because if the show was simply about laughing at people's screw-ups, it would be like biting into one of the dried-out layer cakes the contestants served to the judges. A tough sell. Enter comedian and non-baker Nicole Byer and her pal, real-life pastry genius Jacques Torres, bringing the necessary warmth needed to set the right tone. Byer's willingness to laugh without coming off as cruel is key to the show's success. Number 14 is Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. That was in 2018. Host, cook, and author Sami Nosrat's opening statement, "I've spent my entire life in pursuit of flavor," serves as the guiding principle for every moment that follows. Nosrat's brilliantly clear idea, breaking down cooking into four essential elements, the salt, fat, acid, and heat of the title, is one of those masterful concepts so perfect that you wonder where it's been all your life. Understand these principles and bam, you've unlocked the secret to exceptional meals. So if you're a newbie, clueless, bored, or simply mystified about the whole cooking thing, you owe it to yourself to check this out. A master at removing the intimidation factor from the kitchen, Nosrat is warm, bubbly, and encouraging throughout. Of course, this show isn't just for beginners. Even the most seasoned home chefs will walk away from each lovingly shot episode with new tools, tips, and some major inspiration. One of the shining jewels in the Netflix foodie crown, we give this program and Nosrat all the Michelin stars. Number 15, Somebody Feed Phil. This started in 2018 and is still running. It may not sound like much on paper. A middle-aged Hollywood producer, that's Everyone Loves Raymond, among others, wanders up the world eating. But there's just something about Phil Rosenthal that makes him an ideal host. Is it his personable, big-hearted, and curious nature? Or his wide-eyed pleasure over the deliciousness of whatever he's eating? No matter the reason, the effect is life-affirming, humble charm, with the show devoting a large chunk of time to local charities while showcasing Rosenthal's boundless enthusiasm for every taste, sight, and cultural tidbit from his destinations. Austin to Croatia, Seoul to London. Comedy cameos from his pals, Ray Romano, Patton Oswalt, Allison Janney, and the late Paul Rubens, are icing on the cake along with a healthy helping of humor. A new season dropped on March 1st. Number 16 is Street Food. That ran 2019 to 2022. If you've ever dreamed of eating your way across the world, guilty as charged, street food has got you covered. From Oahu to Lima, Portland to Osaka, this show is a glorious mashup of food and travel. Viewers can rack up honorary frequent flyer miles by witnessing a wild assortment of treats from the streets, vendors, markets, carts, local spots, all of it as delicious and unpretentious as it gets. Brought to you by Chef's Table Masterminds Brian McFinn and David Gelb, this series also puts the spotlight on the cooks, a fascinating bunch, and their stories. That show is Street Food. Number 17 is Sugar Rush from 2018 to 2020. As the title literally promises, Sugar Rush is a show about making outrageously colorful and decadent desserts in a stress-inducingly short amount of time. This pressure cooker of a show is a nail-biting, crave-worthy mad dash to the finish line. One fun perk, besides feasting your eyes on the craziest creations this side of Wonka, is that one of the judges is our favorite inventor, Candace Nelson, creator of the Sprinkles Cupcakes vending machines, thank you very much. Silly, frantic, over the top, and probably not very good for you, this show will satisfy your sweetest cravings. Number 18 is the Taco Chronicles, 2019 to 2022. If you've ever waited in a line at a taco truck, you can attest to the infinite possibilities this handheld mini meal holds. Bean, queso, guac? Nopales, pico, shrimp. Chorizo, carnitas, fajitas? Yes, chef. All of which is to say that tacos are an obvious subject for a docuseries. The show ideas are as endless as the recipes, and this cooking show does it all, showing off gorgeous variations of the dish from around the world while diving into the rich history. From birria to asada, puffy to pescado, no matter how much you think you know about tacos, we guarantee you will learn something new. Like, al pastor came from shawarma? Originally from Mexico, where it was known as Las Crónicas del Taco. This series has a ton of fun with the subject, including a couple of episodes narrated in Spanish by the tacos themselves, in which they sensually declare things like, take a look at me, enjoy me. That is the Taco Chronicles. Number 19 is Ugly Delicious. It's been running since 2018. Ugly Delicious, the celebrated culinary travel show starring the charismatic food fanatic and Momofuku founder David Chang, brings some serious credentials to the table. Produced by Oscar-winning director Morgan Neville, this is the show to beat, combining striking photography, juicy details, comedic touches, and sheer passionate energy that can't be matched. Taking one topic per episode, tacos, pizza, Thanksgiving, and going deep, the series revels in the finer points and never fails to make us hungry. As Entertainment Weekly's writer puts it, Ugly Delicious uses food as a gateway for tackling misconceptions, breaking down cultural barriers, and finding common ground in shared experiences. Not only that, but season 2 reveals a nervous new dad-to-be Chang preparing for his first child in the chef-iest way possible, learning how to make baby food. That's Ugly Delicious. And our number 20 entry, Waffles and Mochi, that ran from 2021 to 2022. Globe-trotting puppets, delicious healthy food, and a glowing Michelle Obama? If you don't have kids, you may have missed this little slice of happiness. But hey, it's never too late to catch up. And we highly recommend that you do, because this show is 100% pure yum. Did we mention it also features two of the cutest cooking show hosts ever? Live from the freezer, it's Waffles, a blue furry monster with waffle ears, and Mochi, a tiny baby-voiced pink ball. With a supporting cast of characters that includes a singing tomato, who sounds suspiciously like Sia, guest visits from Jack Black, Rashida Jones, Zach Galifianakis, and Gaten Matarazzo, plus celeb chefs like Samin Nosrat and Jose Andres, what's not to like? And you don't have to be 6 years old to appreciate this lovely world, even though there are lots of silly touches. Shout out to Steve, a talking mop. There are plenty of old-school PBS Sesame Street doc-style segments, too, featuring real people telling true food tales. The stories are fascinating but simple enough for little ones. Food for thought about the history of what's on their plates. Not bad for a couple of puppets. That was Waffles and Moochie, and that was the 20 best cooking shows on Netflix. I know some of those descriptions emphasized the looks of the food, but I wanted to share because I think the shows also bring more than just what the food looks like. It's understanding the ingredients, it's learning about new places, or just having fun. I hope that was okay. I think this is the last article we have time for. Conan O'Brien's Hot Ones episode is a truly unhinged work of comedic brilliance. This is by Lester Fabian Breathwaite. Conan O'Brien begins his Hot Ones interview clear-eyed and sober, letting host Sean Evans know that he and hot sauce, let alone flavor, are not even distant acquaintances, let alone friends. "I grew up in an Irish house," O'Brien says, "an Irish Catholic home in Boston. I never saw a spice until I was about 52 years old, so I'm horrible with hot food. I grew up on tasteless food. This is a whole new experience for me." For those unfamiliar with the show, the experience is O'Brien eating increasingly spicy hot sauces while answering thoughtful questions from Evans. And what follows is 25 minutes of controlled chaos that has to rank among the craziest and best Hot Ones interviews to date. On the show's season finale, O'Brien injects little bits of his trademark wackiness while plugging his new travelogue show, Conan O'Brien Must Go, on Max, and also kneeing the streamer in the jollies for its confusing HBO-less name change. "I can't get used to it," he says. "It's not a better name." Then there's his alleged doctor, Dr. Arroyo, a man with seemingly no medical qualifications who pops in and out with one-liners. And as part of an ongoing bit, O'Brien keeps sticking half-eaten wings into his pocket. Surprisingly, though, O'Brien is eating the hot sauce like a champ, and he gets more candid the hotter the wings get, displaying an uncomfortable for him, or for us, amount of seriousness. O'Brien discusses the worst thing a guest can do on a talk show, turning to the audience and remarking how bad it's going, because it's just plain unprofessional. I would look out at the audience, maybe 200 people sitting there, and I'd see 200 souls leave 200 bodies and float up through the ceiling, O'Brien says, because they were just told they were not getting a good show. No, that's not show business. Show business is, you're getting the greatest show in the world. And that is Conan O'Brien's comedic ethos. It's a commitment not to a bit, but to the audience, a promise and a guarantee that we'll enjoy ourselves, a promise O'Brien delivers with unhinged enthusiasm. O'Brien not only gets candid, but also cocky, real cocky. "I don't think there's a wing here that I can't eat like it's ice cream," the former late-night host boasts. "Seriously, I don't think there's a wing on this table that I cannot devour like it's cool whipped cream." He then shares a harrowing tale involving a misunderstanding with a water buffalo and recalls writing Saturday Night Live sketches at David Letterman's desk in the 90s, only to take over for Letterman as a host of Late Night. By this point, the spice level has gone up several notches, so O'Brien matches, then exceeds that energy, slathering his latest wing in an atomic-like hot sauce, and then garishly licking it off. O'Brien screams at Evans, "Come on, man! Are we doing this or not? Are we doing this or not? What's the point of even being alive if we can't do this?" His lavish pomodoro shakes vigorously with each exclamation. Evans begins to struggle and hiccup with the heat, and finally his guest is forced to admit, this one, I'm not going to lie, I'm feeling it a little bit. It's just starting to peek through. Minutes later, O'Brien realizes he might have made a terrible mistake. I don't have a lot of regrets in my career, he says, holding up the sauce he had been so cavalier with earlier. But pouring this onto the wing and then licking it off, in retrospect, I'm starting to feel some sensations. Doubling down on his past mistakes, O'Brien takes the next sauce, bathes his wing with it, then rubs it on his hands, onto his mouth, and on his nipples, all over his button-up shirt, exclaiming, I've never felt so alive. I'm erect for the first time in 15 years. At the hottest of the hot sauces, O'Brien takes a swig from the bottle and wonders what's wrong with him and why he can't feel. Then the horror slowly creeps over his watery eyes as the sauce builds on his tongue. His eyes red, his mouth caked in drool. O'Brien yells affirmatively at Evans, I'm fine! I'm perfectly effing fine! Still, in the midst of a capsation delirium, O'Brien is able to answer Evans' final question on what students of comedy ought to read. They could just watch this interview and get all the lessons they need. O'Brien's commitment to the bit is daring and even dangerous. That water buffalo story? O'Brien was in a rehearsal and someone told him to get on top of the animal, and without thinking, he did, and he was almost seriously injured because of it. I just kept thinking, why, he says of the incident. It's because you do a show every day. You get into the, let's go, let's get this thing going. And I'm there, and I'm just thinking about the next thing. A voice just said, hop on, and I did. Because that's show business, and we just got the greatest hot ones in the world. That was Conan O'Brien's Hot Ones episode is a truly unhinged work of comedic brilliance, and it was by Lester Fabian Breathwaite. That was a good article, and also about food. And as I say at the end of our hour, every time, that brings us to the end of the time we have. So thank you for listening to Entertainment Weekly this week. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Come back next week to hear what I've found from their website, Entertainment Weekly. To hear what I found from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. Until next time, goodbye.